From KCRW in Santa Monica and PRI, Public Radio International, this is To the Point.
Tropical Storm Harvey is in a class of its own. Hello again, I'm Oren Almy, and this is To the Point. The rain in Texas continues to set national records. Floodwaters are still rising, and rescue efforts may last not just for days, but for weeks into the future. Some 13 million people live in zones either flooded already or under flood watch, with a trillion gallons of water inundating Harris County in just 4 days. President Trump flew in for a briefing in Corpus Christi as federal agencies joined state and local responders along with civilians. We'll hear how one family waded in chest-deep water, pulling an aging relative on a rubber mattress. Later on today's Talking Point, violence is not the main cause for undocumented immigration from Central America. After all, it's hunger. First, here's the news.
Check out KCRW's All News channel, News 24. Programming from KCRW, NPR, the BBC, and more, 24 hours a day. Check out kcrw.com/news24 or listen on KCRW's app.
Support for To the Point comes from the members of KCRW and from the Public Radio International Program Fund.
Hello again, Mormon Alney, back with To the Point. A challenge to conventional wisdom. It's more hunger than violence that's driving so many Central Americans to the United States. Still, others are here legally as refugees from Hurricane Mitch in 1999, but their relief will be running out early next year. We'll hear more about that on our Talking Point later on in our program. First, the continuing disaster in Texas. President Trump got a briefing today in Corpus Christi, far from operations in Houston that might be disrupted by a visit from the commander-in-chief. Here's the president in a busy command post.
This was of epic proportion. Nobody's ever seen anything like this. And I just want to say that working with the governor and his entire team has been an honor for us. So, Governor, again, thank you very much. And we won't say congratulations. We don't want to do that. We don't want to congratulate. We'll congratulate each other when it's all finished. But you have been terrific, really terrific.
And Governor Abbott said, let me be clear, this is not the Superdome, referring to the handling of Hurricane Katrina when huddled masses took over the football stadium in New Orleans. The real action, again, is in Houston. Nolan Hicks is a reporter for the Austin American-Statesman. He's outside a command center there. Nolan, thanks a lot for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
What can you tell us about what you've seen today?
Well, I've spent most of the day in the command center here for Harris County as they manage their response. The county officials here have been confronting sort of two separate building crises. One, there is a dam west of the city that holds back a flood. It's a flood control reservoir, and the water in the flood control reservoir is pouring in so quickly the dam can't handle it, and it's sloshing over the spillway. There's a second flood control reservoir dam that will start having water come over it, they say, in the next couple of days. And then on the other end of town, on the east side of town, there's the San Jacinto River, which is continuing to flood, and the water levels there are continuing to rise because of all the water that's being pumped into the northern counties through all the rain that's fallen. And officials are warning that conditions there are looking a lot like they did in 1994 when there was a historic flood on that river. And conditions on the river were so bad in 94 that it caused the rupture of a couple of gasoline pipelines, and the river caught fire. And they're closely monitoring the pipeline network that runs under the river to try to keep abreast and to try to head off anything similar from happening again.
Back to the dams, as I understand what you said on the west side of the city, are those controlled by the Army Corps of Engineers? Are those the one that they opened the floodgates to?
Yeah, those are the ones they've opened the floodgates to. Those dams are controlled by the Army Corps of Engineers. Harris County, which is the county Houston sits in, which has a population of about 4 million people, is responsible for sort of attempting to plan around and mitigate the impacts of what the Army Corps of Engineers does with the dams. The Army Corps of Engineers began saying, I think it was, and it's been a long few days, I think it was Sunday, they began talking about the need for controlled releases from the dams, that is opening the floodgates in an attempt to get some of the water out to relieve some of the pressure that was being put against the dams by the surge of stormwater coming in from rural creeks towards the Gulf of Mexico. And their goal was to start pumping out about 8,000 cubic feet of water per second. That's about 60,000 gallons of water a second by sometime Monday. as of this morning, they had only managed to get the gates for both of the dams open to the point where they could pump out about 4,000 of those cubic feet of water per second, so about half of what they were aiming for. And it was at that press conference where they announced that there were going to be that one dam had already started spilling over and the second would start in the next couple of days. That water is flowing into Buffalo Bayou, which is sort of the best way to think of it is a river that runs through the city. It bisects the city, running all the way from the suburbs out in Katy all the way to the Ship Channel, which links to the Gulf of Mexico. And that bayou is already flooding. It's flooded a whole number of neighborhoods through West Houston. And there are a lot of concerns that the flooding will get worse there. County officials say that the controlled releases into the dam, this is not the uncontrolled releases, but so far the controlled releases into the dam have not exacerbated flooding along the bayou because the rain has dialed back to the point where instead of the bayou going down, the controlled releases are just sort of holding it at the current flood level. But there are real concerns that the uncontrolled releases coming from the dam into the bayou may exacerbate flooding along Buffalo Bayou.
Okay, obviously the situation is very dire. For those who haven't seen the pictures on television, just describe Houston, how it looks now as compared to the way it normally looks.
Well, it really depends on what part of town you're in. My parents live about 15 blocks from Buffalo Bayou and just outside of a neighborhood called Montrose. And outside of some ponding on the streets, their house is perfectly fine. But if you were to go 10 miles down Westheimer, which is a major road by their house, towards the west and then turn up towards Buffalo Bayou, you would run into waist-deep water that has just consumed some of the houses that have been built along the bayou, a lot of the houses up there that have been built along the bayou, at the intersection of Gessner and Briar Woods, which is a couple major intersections just right by Beltway 8, which is a major freeway here in town. The water is waist deep. It's rushing. And I was out there yesterday talking to folks who got pulled by Good Samaritans and put in a boat and taken to shelter. It's a harrowing scene in a lot of places across the city. West Houston's been hit pretty badly. East Houston has, by most accounts, been hit even worse. It's lower. More rain fell over there. And there are large parts of the city.
Okay.
That take
if
a
you
long
don't
time.
Know the city, it looks like a lake rather than a metropolitan area. We'll be back with Nolan Hicks. We'll talk to others as well as Tropical Storm Harvey sets national records for rainfall and, of course, rescues and all the rest. This is To the Point from PRI.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
KCRW thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com.
Warman only back with To the Point. Just before the president arrived in Corpus Christi, Texas Governor Greg Abbott spoke briefly with reporters.
Everyone in the state of Texas is focused first on saving every life that we can. Then we want to help in the evacuation and transition process. And in typical Texas fashion, we will rebuild and make it better than ever. The president and his team have been talking to us about providing tremendous aid. It'll be one of the things that we talk in more detail about today. It'll be something that the president is able to provide from his resources, but also a part will be an appropriation from the United States Congress.
Don Kettle is a professor at the University of Maryland. He's author of Escaping Jurassic Government, Restoring America's Lost Commitment to Competence. Professor, good to have you on our program.
It's great to be with you there, Warren.
When we talk about the president and Congress, the president has cut back on FEMA and other such federal assistance programs. Congress had a lot of trouble with Hurricane Sandy. Tell us about the lost commitment to competence, and are you worried about that?
I think there's a whole set of really tough problems lying ahead, which begin with the fact that we're just beginning to get a sense of how large this disaster is going to be and how much it's going to cost, but nobody really knows what the bill is going to be. And This is all falling in the middle of a battle where the White House and the Congress have had a hard time agreeing on passing anything, and where the administration in particular has already been talking about, before the storm hit, of dialing back on federal commitments on natural disasters and flooding in particular. So we're looking at just tough, tough problems in terms of the scale of this disaster, the difficulty of getting the White House and the president to agree, and the challenge of trying to figure out, even more importantly going down the road, how we're going to put restrictions on rebuilding so that we don't end up putting people right back in harm's way all over again, right in the middle of the battle that we were already going to have on the future flood insurance. So there's just one problem layered on top of another, none of which anybody really knows how to solve at this point.
Just quickly before we lose him, let me go back to Nolan Hicks at the Austin American Statesman, who's in Houston. The Texas resources, Nolan, are pretty well being used up. The entire Texas National Guard, I understand, has been deployed. What are they doing?
Well, that's there have been helicopters flying over the city. There have been conducting rescues by air. There have been a lot of boats from the Houston Police Department to Harris County. Harris County has its own set of boats, and boats from the Austin Police Department and other police departments and fire departments from around the state and from around the country. I saw a truck from Ohio pulling some boats from the Ohio Task Force that used for water rescues. And they've been out, and they've been very active. I saw the Ohio Task Force out driving into the waters that I was telling you about just before you went to the break. And we've been seeing video images of helicopters flying over the city and of boats, both from fire departments and from police departments and from civilians who have been recruited by local authorities to come in and help. It's been an all-hands-on-deck response.
All right, Nolan Hicks, I know you're very, very busy at the command center there in Houston with the Austin American Statesman. Thanks so much for joining our program.
Thanks for having me.
In other respects, and in many cases, for many people, it is fend for yourself. Here's just one story of what it's been like in Houston since the very beginning. On Saturday, Roxanne Emblad's daughter-in-law had a baby. Roxanne and other family members left the newborn and parents in the hospital at 11 o'clock Saturday evening. I asked her what it was like to drive home.
Well, I have to say it probably wasn't the wisest decision, but we were anxious to get back home because we were in such a horrible storm and felt that that would be the best place, is to just get back home. I was a passenger, so we couldn't see in front of us. Could not, because it was so dark, you can't see what's road and what was water. And you try to see the lights in front of you, and then suddenly there would be cars coming the wrong direction on the freeway headed towards us.
Okay, so you didn't get home. Where did you end up?
Well, I ended up at my daughter-in-law's mother's home, and that's where we kind of hunkered down for the night. One of the people I was with woke up and stepped into water, and so the house was taking on water.
So that was a one-story house?
Yes, it was a one-story house. We quickly, everybody gathered up what they could, knowing that we needed to evacuate that house and go to higher ground.
So where did you go?
We went right next door to the neighbor's house that had a two-story home, and went to the top floor, waited for morning to come up so we can assess the situation. Contacted the Coast Guard and the local rescue division here, and at least got our name on the list, was actually able to talk with a person who took our information and our location and put us on the list of that they could get to us when they could.
On the list, and they'd get to you when they could. Were you a very high priority or not?
I would say that we weren't, because we didn't have any life-threatening situation. We didn't have medical emergencies, even though I told them I had an elderly person with me. They understood that, but there were other people that were in one-story houses that needed out. And I said, completely understand. He says, now, if your situation changes, please call us back. And he says, but we'll get to you as soon as we can.
Okay. Then on Sunday morning, you decided that you would leave. And tell us how you managed to transport that elderly person you referred to.
We noticed out of the window that there were people that had air mattresses, and one neighbor walked over and he says, you know, if you guys want to try getting out, here's the way y'all can do it. Get on this blow-up air mattress, put the grandmother on there, and y'all will just walk with her and wade out of here. And It was kind of hard to think, wrap my brain around, because anything I've ever understood is stay put and some will come rescue you. This was kind of risky that, you know, if we step in a pothole or a manhole, any kind of currents, we're going to go under.
How high was the water that you had to wade through?
At some points, it was chest high on me, and I'm only 5'4", so it was cold, and it was deep at points, and we couldn't see fire hydrants. We were stepping off curbs, running into fire hydrants, and we walked a mile to get to the front subdivision.
Walked a mile, and at the same time, you were floating the grandmother along on the air mattress.
Absolutely, with what possessions they could get to be able to survive for however long we were going to be displaced. We got to the front of the subdivision where a neighbor had his truck, and he was able to then bring us the few miles we needed to get to my son's new home, where we are high and dry.
Okay, you're high and dry now, but how easy is it going to be to get anyplace?
Well, it's not. It's not easy. We can navigate a few streets around us, but all the exit roads are flooded. Getting anywhere is flooded. And I actually live north of Houston, which is about an hour and a half from here, and there's no way I can get home right now.
All right, Roxanne Imblad, we're going to have to leave you there, but at least you're high and dry. Thanks so much for joining us.
Well, we're very thankful, and we certainly see God's hand all over this and how he's protected us. And my new little granddaughter, I think I'm going to nickname her Stormy.
Stormy and her parents are still at the hospital, which raises the question, how are health facilities holding up? Scott Knowles is a professor at Drexel University. He's author of The Disaster Experts, Mastering Risk in Modern America. Good to have you on our program.
Thank you, Warren.
Are hospitals, such as the one we have heard about, but not by name, learning how to cope with a situation like this, given that there have been past disasters?
In general, I would say when we talk about learning from disaster, the outlook, from my perspective, has been pretty bleak, except in the case of hospitals. We have seen quite a bit of learning that's taken place, and there have been many opportunities to do that learning. In Houston's case, it was Tropical Storm Allison that hit in June of 2001. And I think that case may be often overlooked because September 11 attacks happened not long after that. But the cost to the Texas Medical Center, for example, in Tropical Storm Allison was $2 billion, and it was really enormous losses. They lost tissue specimens, long-term research projects were lost, and then they were managing an evacuation of the hospital in the middle of rising waters that didn't look very different from what you're seeing right now.
So they then had that situation. What have they done to prepare in the meantime?
So there was a real, hard look there after Allison, you know, basically saying we can't let something like this happen again. And 160,000 people go in and out of that medical complex every day, and it's almost a tenth of the population of the city. So they approached it in two ways. One was a sort of physical structural way, and they put in, much like you might like for an entire city, they put in basically a flood control system for the medical center. Some of that is relatively low-tech earthen berms and things like that. Others is a much more high-tech floodgate system to keep the basements dry. And, of course, that why do you want to keep the basements dry has a lot to do with protecting the generating system, because you can't have the power go out at a hospital. So those are some of the things. And then in terms of the people, they really have done a lot in terms of planning for emergencies, and they've even developed their own emergency operating center. So much like you have for a whole city, you'll have also at the scale of the hospital. And that was picked up by other hospitals across the country. So they're monitoring at the medical center right now the meteorological situation and the bayou situation, so that they can make decisions there what they might need to do.
Let me introduce a doctor who is coping with the situation as we speak. Ashish Kamat is a professor of urology and director of the Urological Center, a Urological Oncology Fellowship at the University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center. That is the largest cancer hospital in the world. People fly in from all over to take advantage of the facilities and the resources and the professionals such as Dr. Kamat. And thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Tell us what your life is like right now and how it's going in the hospital.
Oh, well, I mean, that's a broad question you're asking. As far as life is concerned in Houston, you've heard, of course, from others on the radio, and I won't go into that. Speaking specifically about the medical center, it's just been crazy. I mean, on Friday, when we knew that this was happening, of course, preparations were already well underway. What we call write-out teams, teams of professionals, MDs, nurses, mid-level providers, and even volunteers had been organized already. And then as it hit Saturday and Sunday, obviously a lot of folks realized that even though they had volunteered to come to the hospital in times of emergency, there was just no way into the hospital. And it's been rather frustrating for many people who want to come in and want to help out, but they just can't leave where they're living. The hospital itself, though, and I'm speaking for MD Anderson Cancer Center, but of course my wife works at Houston Methodist, which is right across the street and is another large center, and I have friends and colleagues at the other hospitals in the medical center. The hospitals themselves, without exception, have managed to really take care of all the patients that are currently in the hospital extremely well. So there's been no real major catastrophes as far as that's concerned.
So we can assume then that Stormy, the baby we heard about earlier, is probably okay. Why are the teams called ride-out teams? What does that mean?
You're riding out the storm, essentially. So when you volunteer to be part of the ride-out team, and it's funny, when we ask for volunteers, we get more volunteers than we need. So, of course, we then create little shift volunteer ride-out teams. But it's mainly teams that are riding out the storm.
So do you think that it will be possible to get patients in anytime soon, particularly those that are suffering from emergency situations?
That's the million-dollar question, I mean, both literally and figuratively. The roads are passable right now, but a lot of the facilities have suffered damage from rainwater. And in general, it's very important to prioritize needs of healthcare providers and, of course, patients. So you mentioned emergency situations, absolutely. I mean, those, even though most of the hospitals are closed for elective procedures, emergency care is available. Obviously, I'm not recommending that people come into the hospital if they think they're having an emergency situation. They should call 911. They should call the appropriate people and get professional advice on where they should go. But emergency situations are being handled. It's the elective appointments, surgeries, and chemotherapy, et cetera, that's being delayed so long as there's not a major impact on the patient's health.
You're knowledgeable about so many hospitals. Tell us, if you will, do they have electrical generators? Have they had any problems with power? And what about food? Can they get food supplies?
The electrical power in general has been fairly stable except for one large trauma center right here in the medical center, Bentaub. And, you know, that is the largest trauma center for our region. It takes care of a lot of indigent patients. There was trouble there with the generator, which I believe has been corrected. I'm not directly involved with that hospital. Food is a little bit of an issue. There's enough supplies, of course, for nutrition and caloric intake, but fresh food or palatable food, especially in patients that are currently undergoing chemotherapy or even volunteers that are in the hospital, are potentially going to run scarce. That being said, agencies such as HEB, Kroger, here even Randall's and Whole Foods, they're doing their bit to try and help the medical center out.
Okay.
So things don't look quite as bad as they might have seemed initially.
We just have a few seconds before we need to go to a break, and I know you need to leave us. Are you worried about being inundated with medical cases after this is over or as it's ending?
Worried? No. Preparing for it? Absolutely.
Ashish Kamat again, a doctor of urology and director of the Urologic Oncology Fellowships at University of Texas MD Anderson Center. Thank you so very much for joining us.
My pleasure.
On our talking point later, violence is not the main cause for undocumented immigration from Central America. After all, it's hunger.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing.
Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW Donation Car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Marvin Ali back with To The Point, still talking, of course, about what's happening in Houston and the surrounding area. We just heard from a doctor who is at the MD Anderson Cancer Center, largest cancer hospital in the world, about how they're functioning and some nearby hospitals as well. Scott Knowles, back to you at Drexel University, author of The Disaster Experts, Mastering Risk in Modern America. Does that sound to you like a report that indicates people have, in fact, learned from what's happened in the past and have been well prepared for what's going on now, despite the fact that it couldn't have been predicted to the extent that it's turned out to be?
I think in the narrow case of the medical center, there some things he was pointing to there, like the electrical generators, you know, that's evidence of lessons learned and the ride-out teams and things like that. But it still doesn't cope with some of the other problems he was talking about, is whether or not people can get around the city and can they get to the medical center if they need to. So some of those are lessons that you can't learn unless you deal with the broader context, which is preventing that much water from coming into the city and preventing that kind of flooding. These are the kind of things that go beyond the sort of preparations that can take place in one site. Now you're talking about sort of citywide preparations that have to be taken into account. I think we've seen this kind of discussion already in the debate that's happened around the evacuation and whether or not the city should have evacuated. And listeners may know that in 2005 with Hurricane Rita, there was an ordered evacuation of Houston, which came under a lot of scrutiny afterwards because 3.7 million people moved and there were over 100 deaths that resulted. So it's not an easy call either way. And when we start to look at what kind of lessons can you learn from these disasters, they're, in a sense, each one can be very unique to the city and the kind of hazards that they're facing.
Back to Don Kettle again, professor of public policy at the University of Maryland. How does this look to you in terms of the agencies that are involved? And will the hospitals get the necessary assistance that they need? Will the millions of people who may not need hospitalization but need to be rescued be well handled?
So far, what we've seen is a pretty remarkable response, as best we could tell. But the problem is that the full dimension of what we're facing is only just becoming clear. And it's clear we're now going to be going through a series of stages. The first is just evacuating people who need to be gotten out of flooded homes. And there, the disaster has just overwhelmed the capacity. And the volunteer corps of people from other states coming in to try to help has been a big help. But it's one of those things that you can anticipate, but you can never have enough resources in place. And that's the first stage. The second stage is going to be temporary housing for literally tens of thousands of people who can't move back to their homes because of the flooding. The next stage after that is going to be repairing the homes as best they can and to rebuild the infrastructure to make sure that the roads and the bridges and all the things that have been destroyed or at least damaged are put back in shape, including those dams that are so critical. And then the last and the critical piece is going to be rebuilding. That's going to involve the question of writing the checks and determining what kind of regulations are going to be about who can rebuild what where. And that gets right back to some of those questions that Scott has talked about that really get into the long-term questions of helping to try to protect Houston from another disaster of this kind, at least to the degree to which it's possible to do so.
We heard earlier the governor of Texas saying that we're going to fix this in good old Texas fashion. Hasn't Texas and Houston in particular allowed the building of subdivisions on land, which we've heard referred to on this program earlier in the week as the sponge that could have taken up a lot of this water and consequently made things worse by virtue of the way that the city has been developed? Is there a chance that they might learn from that and not expand further? Or are the compulsions to move out and buy land and build on it just too great?
Well, the two big questions that are lurking out there is, first, who's going to write the checks to pay for the support that's going to be needed? And second, what kind of restrictions are there going to be? And it's clear that lots of new homes and lots of new development has happened on lands that are very vulnerable. And that Texas has been a place for a very long time where the state government has done its very best to limit the ability of local governments to put these restrictions on. We're going to have a new debate over the future of flood insurance. That is, what kind of insurance you need to buy and where you have to buy flood insurance to develop. And there's been a lot of resistance on the part of a lot of people about even charting where the flood zones might be, because then it gets into questions about climate change and whether or not the climate is changing, whether sea levels are rising, whether more of these neighborhoods are more vulnerable. And a lot of people just don't want to go there with these questions. So we're going to be facing and confronting very tough questions about what kinds of restrictions governments are going to be able to put on the ability of people to rebuild their homes and where in the future development is going to happen. This is going to happen not only in Houston, but it's going to be an issue that echoes around the country as well. So that's something we're going to need to belt ourselves in for, because that's going to be a tough and big national debate at the very time when the National Flood Insurance Program was on the verge of being renewed anyway. And we were in the process of framing this no matter what was happening.
We'll talk about this more extensively later in the week, but aren't the insurers and the reinsurers concerned about this? Don't they have a voice in Congress? Because this is going to cost them a lot of money.
This is going to cost them a fortune. And the big question is going to be, first, I mean, how much is this going to cost? Second is, who's going to pay for the flood insurance coverage that some people already have? Most people in Texas don't have flood insurance, so who pays for the rest of it? Then there are the private insurance companies standing there, and the reinsurers, who are the people who insure the insurance companies, are in looking at and just enormous bills that they're going to be facing as well. They're going to be looking at questions about, again, how to try to prevent people from rebuilding in areas and make them vulnerable all over again. And there's going to be a question of backstopping some of them, as well as dividing responsibility between the federal and the state and the local government. So the underlying questions all set against the political battles that happened with Superstorm Sandy, where some of the members of Congress from Texas were strongly opposed to the idea of providing government support for people on the East Coast who suffered severe damage. We're going to be seeing fierce political battles and a pretty important fundamental policy question about how we sort out the questions of vulnerability at a time when it's pretty clear we're going to be going through this again.
We've already heard Governor Christie of New Jersey speaking out very harshly against the senators from Texas who refused to vote for the bill that Governor Christie wanted to provide rebuilding and recovery efforts there. Let's talk about the industry, one of the major industries in Houston, which, of course, is the oil industry. And Laura Blewett is with us. She is an energy reporter for Bloomberg News. She also lives in Houston. Laura, thanks a lot for joining us.
Hey, no problem.
Anything you want to add from a personal point of view, or would you want to, shall we just talk about the about the energy industry?
I have been extremely lucky on a personal note. I have not had any flooding in my home. My friends and family are all safe and dry. So, but my heart is broken, of course, seeing the devastation in my city.
What about all those refineries and the fact that the port is now closed? You can't get crude in, you can't get oil out. What does that mean for Houston and the rest of the country?
Yeah, well, it's actually not just Houston. As you guys know, that the storm initially hit in Corpus Christi, where there was also a cluster of refineries. And the storm has been moving really slowly to the east, so it eventually hit the refineries in Houston, and now it's hitting refineries in the Port Arthur, Texas area, which is right on the border of Louisiana. And so, yeah, with these ports being closed down, the refiners are unable to bring crude supplies in, and therefore they're running out of the supplies they need to make gasoline and diesel. So we're going to probably be seeing significant shortages in Texas, of course, where the immediate gasoline supplies will be sent. Today, one of the major pipelines that sends fuels north to the Chicago area and Oklahoma, that pipeline will be shut just for 2 days starting tomorrow, but that can have an impact on prices for the Midwest. And then looking over at New York, we're just very, very closely watching a pipeline that ships basically over a million barrels a day of gasoline to the East Coast. If that line shuts in, then the East Coast could be looking at shortages and higher prices. So far that pipeline is still shipping supplies, and it's kind of, again, a wait and see situation at this point. We'll know more by tomorrow.
It's shipping supplies, but no new supplies are being generated?
Exactly.
So this obviously has an
enough.
Oh, go ahead.
Oh, yeah. Well, the good thing is our refiners have had a really busy summer, and they've been breaking records all summer long with the amount of gasoline they're producing and the amount of oil that they're refining. So we have really healthy stockpiles that we're sitting on, and we'll be able to draw out of those.
So at the moment, at least, then, there's no emergency situation. But if this continues, is one likely to develop?
We'll see. We'll see. It's very possible, but the storm so far hasn't caused super extreme damage to any of the refineries. So they should be up and running by the next week or probably the next week.
And what about refineries around the country? When a number of them shut down, as has happened in both Houston and Corpus Christi, and now apparently in Port Arthur as well, does that mean that gasoline prices go up elsewhere because the refineries in other places have a product that everybody needs?
Yeah, definitely. And we saw that during Hurricane Katrina. The New York area and East Coast and Florida, for example, those regions all really depend on the Gulf Coast. So, we're possibly going to see much higher gasoline prices in the next couple of weeks.
All right, Laura Blewett with Bloomberg News, high and dry, though, in her home in Houston. Scott Knowles, back to you at Drexel University, the disaster experts, mastering risk in modern America. What are the major problems you see looking forward, particularly if the rain continues to fall at its present rate, which is staggering in its duration and the volume of water that's been coming down?
I think what they're really looking at right now, I mean, we're 12 years to the day since they opened the Superdome New Orleans for sheltering. And, of course, no one wants to see a situation like that. But, I mean, we're seeing already reports that there may be as many as 30,000 people seeking shelter. So, there'll be many others who will be trying to self-evacuate from the city. So just imagining that many people trying to move around the city in the midst of this very dynamic situation, that's something of really great concern. And then, as Don Kettle pointed to, you know, this is going to evolve in stages. So when the water does recede, it's still hot there. Mold is a big problem. You know, getting people back into their homes fast enough to try to prevent further damage and short-term housing. Those are going to be big issues. I think on the political side, you know, I would hope that we're going to see a pretty swift discussion by the Congress about bringing relief to the situation. You know, after Hurricane Sandy, there was over 2 months went by before Congress actually began to appropriate funds. So I'm really hoping that we'll see, you know, a little less divisiveness in the political culture, and that this could actually be a moment that there could be some coming together around that discussion. But
all right.
Maybe not too hopeful based on what we saw after Hurricane Sandy. And that's going to play a big role on how quickly people can get back into their homes and how quickly, business can get restarted in Houston.
President Trump promising that relief will be fast, but Congress, of course, not even in session as yet. Laura Blewett, back to you. What about the people who work in those refineries, not all of whom live next door, presumably? Are they going to be displaced?
Yeah, it's definitely a possibility. We know a lot of workers have been evacuated, of course, due to high water. When you think about the location of the Houston refineries, a lot of them are very close to the water or on the water. So, for example, Baytown, Texas has a really massive refinery operated by ExxonMobil. All those workers are there. There's high waters coming up in that neighborhood, for one example, and then just moving eastward to the border with Louisiana, those towns are starting to see higher water, too.
Don Kettle, back to you at the University of Maryland. After Katrina, of course, a lot of people moved out of New Orleans permanently, and the city is now a much smaller place than it was in terms of population prior to that event. Do you think a lot of people will move out of Houston? A lot of people, of course, who moved into Houston came from New Orleans.
That was one of the most amazing things that happened. And so there's some people who are now going through this a second time in less than 15 years. So it is just stunning here. But the reality here is that Houston is the fourth largest city in the country. It is enormous in terms of size and geography. Some people may decide to move, but it's a different kind of town with a larger economy. It's a richer community because of the oil and gas industry, too, on top of that. So it's unlikely people are going to move. And it's not clear exactly where they would go to and be able to take those kind of jobs with them. That really makes even more important the questions about strategies that the community is going to put in place to try to rebuild, and what the overall pattern between the state and local governments and the overall federal regulations are going to be in conditioning how the money is going to flow and what kind of rules and regulations they're going to have to follow. Because it seems unlikely to me that such a large city is going to pick itself up and have so many people move outside when there's so many good jobs there to begin with.
Scott Knowles, is it, though, going to be a different place?
Absolutely. I mean, they were already trying to make it a different place before. I mean, this is one of the most tragic elements of this, is that, you know, they've been having these large-scale floods going back to Allison, and then the floods in 2015 and 2016. The city already had on the books a Rebuild Houston project and a Braes Bayou project. I mean, at the city level, they have been trying to tackle these generation-long infrastructure failure issues. But it's hard to do that in real time as these storms continue to happen. And then with tepid state support and then very uncertain federal support for pretty basic infrastructure upgrades, it's going to be hard for them to accomplish that. You know, one would think that a disaster of this scale would open up the Treasury and, you know, allow people to make sensible decisions on building protective infrastructure. But I'm not seeing the political climate for that right now. So, you know, Houston's going to be a different place, but I think a lot of that's going to be driven by the city. I don't have a lot of confidence right now that the federal government will drive those changes.
All right. Thanks to all of our guests very much for being with us today. Scott Knowles at Drexel University, author of The Disaster Experts, Mastering Risk in Modern America. Don Kettle, professor of public policy at the University of Maryland. Laura Blewett at Bloomberg News, living in Houston. And thanks to our other guests as well. We're very glad to have had you all, and we'll hear more, of course, about what's going on in Houston tomorrow and in what's going on in Washington as the week goes by. In a moment, new advice for President Trump on illegal border crossings by Central Americans on To the Point from Public Radio International.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
We're on here with today's talking point. Murder and other violent crimes have driven thousands of people, including many children, to cross into the U.S. after long and dangerous trips from El Salvador, Honduras, and Guatemala. But a coalition of international aid agencies says that's not all. Even more are fleeing their home, not because of crime, but because of hunger. Teresa Walsh is with the Washington Bureau of McClatchy, and thanks a lot for being on our program.
Thanks so much for having me.
Tell us now about this. There's a new study. Is it that crime has been exaggerated as a cause for leaving, or simply that hunger has overtaken it?
So I don't think it's necessarily that crime has been exaggerated, but I think it's sort of the more glamorous cause. People like to look at that. It's very dramatic. And, you know, we've seen that a little bit from the administration with the emphasis on eradicating crime, particularly the drug trade, gangs in Central America. But hunger is one of, obviously, our most basic needs as humans. And if you can't feed your family, you're going to move. And you have an extraordinary amount of people in these three countries, El Salvador, Guatemala, Honduras, known as the Northern Triangle, that cannot put food on the table for their families. And that is the major driver for migration across our southern border.
Tell us about the temporary protective status agreement in the Obama administration pushed very hard.
So temporary protected status is a U.S. immigration program that actually has been in place since before the Obama administration. Oh. And the U.S. grants it to countries that have experienced natural disasters or having civil wars or have particularly dangerous conditions on the ground in which the State Department and the administration has decided, along with DHS, has decided that these people should be able to remain in the United States temporarily, legally, until conditions in their home country improve. So both El Salvador and Guatemala actually currently are recipients of TPS, temporary protected status, and those are actually both due to natural disasters that they've experienced. So we're obviously seeing a massive natural disaster play out in our own country, which is going to cause displacement. A lot of people are losing their homes, everything they own, losing their businesses, and, you know, I imagine some of those people from the Houston area are going to relocate, and that's something that a lot of people have experienced in Central America as well. And these people have been in the United States and are able to be here legally with work permits, own homes, have businesses. Many have U.S. citizen children. And these exemptions, the way the program is currently set up, are renewed routinely every 18 months. And for both El Salvador and Honduras, two of our Northern Triangle countries, those designations expire early next year. So it's going to be up to the Trump administration to decide what it's going to do with this program.
Okay, we're talking about two different problems here. One of them is the issue, well, three really. There's crime, there's hunger, and there's also the protective status agreements that allow people to stay here. And as you indicated, many of them have really settled down, but their status agreements may run out or will run out very soon. Has the Trump administration had anything to say about that? There are those who are saying that if the Trump administration really cared about immigration, what it would do, and this is the new advice I referred to earlier, is to help those countries to reestablish themselves and ease the kinds of issues that we're talking about.
Exactly, and that's an argument that some make. And actually, under the Obama administration, they began a program that's called the Alliance for Prosperity that was modeled after Plan Colombia, which was basically an initiative to really build up civil society, build up government institutions, and create a country that people feel no need to leave, create a place where people can meet their basic needs and lead successful, fulfilling lives and not need to flee to the United States. And so the Trump administration has not indicated what it's going to do, particularly on El Salvador and Honduras yet regarding TPS. They did issue an extension for Haiti, which is another country that obviously has experienced massive natural disasters and is also a TPS designee, and they extended the program for just 6 months rather than the routine 18 months, so that was a little bit of a red flag for people who are watching this, perhaps might be an indication that the Trump administration does not plan to continue renewing these designations.
And a lot of Haitians are moving into Canada. Well, let's get back to the question of hunger, because it's not just a shortage of food. It's I take it, in many cases, people ceasing to work in agriculture because they have to sell the equipment and the materials that they need in order to grow food so that they can have the money to pay for food.
Exactly. And so that was one of the main findings of this report produced by the World Food Program in conjunction with several other international organizations, including the Organization of American States, the OAS, the IDB, the Inter-American Development Bank, and several others. And they interviewed tons of people in these Northern Triangle countries to figure out what are the drivers for migration? Why are you leaving your homes? And hunger and food insecurity was the leading answer to that question. And they found that 72% of the people that they spoke to were already taking those emergency steps that you mentioned, which is, you know, selling land, selling livestock, selling perhaps farming equipment, tools, to meet their immediate needs to put food on the table now. And while, of course, that solves the short-term problem, you then are left in a position where long-term they have completely depleted their assets that were allowing them to earn money and to eat. and they no longer have those things. And so that's a massive problem for these countries that also have been really impacted by climate change, by El Nino, as well as other natural disasters that just generally make agriculture more difficult when you've got people that are, you know, growing food for their own families to feed their families, as well as, you know, that's their livelihood and they're trying to sell that.
I understand there's been drought.
Exactly. There's been drought as well, which, you know, as I just mentioned, is a huge problem when you are relying on agriculture. And, you know, a lot of these people don't necessarily have any other options. And that's one of the things that leads them to flee. And then some of these families, when they've got members that are in the United States, are here and are working, they rely really, really heavily on remittances. And, you know, if you are deciding that either through the TPS program or through the Trump administration's wider crackdown on immigration, that you're going to be removing these people from the U.S. and sending them back, you're also cutting off those lifelines for those people back in country. You know, 78% of Hondurans get remittances, and 42% say that that's their only income. So what do those people do when, you know, their family member is no longer allowed to work in the United States?
Do we have any idea how many people we're talking about?
Well, with regards to TPS status, there are over 200,000 El Salvadorans and about 61,000 Hondurans. And so, you know, that's quite a few families that would be impacted if those people were told to leave.
Guatemala not involved?
No, Guatemala does not currently have TPS.
On the other hand, there are plenty of Guatemalans here, and similar situation must apply to them.
Yeah, there's obviously quite a few Guatemalans, and, you know, they were included in this study as a member of the Northern Triangle and are experiencing, you know, some of the drought issues. And they, you know, have the same problems that the other countries have in terms of families trying to figure out how to put food on the table. And, you know, is it worth taking the risk to have someone come to the United States? Because another problem that they face is if you've sent a family member and they are not successful in crossing the border and you have probably paid a lot to a smuggler, your family is then in debt and you don't have any of that money coming home from a remittance because the family member didn't actually reach the United States. So it's a huge gamble.
We have just seconds left, but what about diplomacy? President Trump and Central American leaders, do they have relationships?
So they do, and the Alliance for Prosperity obviously is a big part of that. And Vice President Mike Pence actually has sort of headed up Central American relations, which sort of is following in the footsteps of the Obama administration. We saw Vice President Joe Biden really take the lead on Central America. And El Salvador and Honduras actually both have publicly called for the Trump administration to extend TPS to their citizens.
Okay. Well, Teresa Welch, thanks so much for being on our program.
Thank you so much for having me.
Teresa Welch is in the Washington Bureau for McClatchy. I'm Armin Alney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live and podcast as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.